Chanel here. Welcome to Menopause Nutritionist. I believe women can thrive in menopause and have the body composition of their choice if they master their nutrition and lifestyle.
Well, people, I'm super excited to have Dr. Cliff Harvey with us today. Cliff has been like a major influence in my course of becoming a nutritionist, and I'm super grateful that I probably 6 years ago I met Cliff. So he is a very clever person, and I'm really excited that we get to chat today. Cliff, basically we're kind of chatting to my menopausal tribe, so the audience is, you know, kind of 40 plus. So I wanted to kind of like pre-frame that so you kind of know like who the audience is as we kick off today. And thanks for joining us from New Zealand.
Hey, my pleasure. It's great to talk with you, Chanel.
Yeah, well, like I said, we're pretty much over here educating like 40 plus. So you're either on your menopause journey or you're heading that direction. So realizing that lifestyle needs to change, like food needs to change, nutrition needs to be looked at, you know, all of these different factors that can really change the trajectory of how you deal with this phase of life. What I love, obviously, and why I guess like I've always kind of connected with you, and for those of you who don't know, like I've learnt my nutrition through Cliff. Like Cliff is, you know, one of my teachers, if you like. And so he is like a bit of a trailblazer in the low carb community. And so I love his approach about being carb appropriate. So I would love you to kind of expand on that, Cliff, because I think we've been talking a little bit about carbohydrates and how much we need to eat. And these days, this seems to have really gone out of whack. So I'd love to get your take and your kind of philosophy around being carb appropriate.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring it up because, you know, obviously I did my master's and PhD research in various aspects of ketogenesis. And so, you know, starting off well after I started working with the stuff in practice, obviously, but, you know, I started off looking at MCTs, and their effect on ketosis, induction of ketosis, symptoms of keto flu. Went on and expanded that research in my doctoral studies, looking at, you know, time to induction of ketosis again, keto flu. You know, we did really groundbreaking work, which sort of reframed what keto flu actually was, because before we studied it, it wasn't really studied very well at all. And because of that, you know, because I did that research through my master's and doctorate, so you could say that I literally have a doctorate in ketosis and ketogenesis. And because I'd been working at that stage, or, you know, to this point now, with low carb and ketogenic diets for over 25 years, going 26 years now, a lot of people would say that, you know, I'm a keto guy. And I think that would be as far from the truth as you could be, because it's certainly not about, you know, low carb or keto. And a lot of people can fall into real dogma. You know, you've got to be keto, you've got to be low carb, or you've got to be high carb, you've got to be low fat. You know, there are a lot of dogma out, or a lot of dogmatic schools out there. But as you say, my approach, I sum up under this term of carb appropriate. And I started talking about that, you know, really in my earliest years of practice. So again, we're going back a quarter of a century. I started talking about this idea of carb appropriate. And I'll tell you where it came from, because it was a really interesting sort of genesis for it, because to me, at least, it made complete sense. And when I speak to people about it now, they're like, oh yeah, that does make sense. And basically where it came from was that when I was studying first time around, I was at university studying nutrition and strength training and a few other things. And in our anatomy and physiology classes, obviously, we would learn the sort of physiology of nutrition. Right. So we would learn about the roles and functions of the nutrients in the body. And, you know, we would obviously learn that protein provides the primary structure for the cells, tissues, organs, systems of the body. Fat provides both structure and energy provision. Of course, protein provides some energy, but very little. And carbohydrate is predominantly there for fuel provision. But then we would go next door to nutrition class, and we would be taught that you need to provide a high proportion of the diet from carbohydrate, sort of irrespective of what else was going on. We should be prescribing, you know, back in the day, they were telling us, you know, 60-65% plus percent calories from carbohydrate. And so when I started thinking about that and started working out some plans for the clients that I was starting to see, it didn't make sense, because if I looked at the emerging research, particularly on protein, what I was seeing is that if I allocated that high amount of carbohydrate to a lot of my initial clients, there wasn't enough to optimize protein intakes as along with preserving like a minimum threshold of fat to preserve hormonal balance and to help prevent the risks of overtraining and all sorts of things, to preserve enough essential fatty acid intake from diet. It's kind of interesting because I think I often find myself in the middle, because for a lot of the keto zealots out there, I'm not like keto enough, because I'm not promoting keto as the solution. Obviously, for a lot of people that are more biased towards low fat, high carb, you know, my message is unpalatable as well, because I'm opening the door to keto and low carb.
Yes.
You know, and the idea that springs from the idea of carb appropriate. And I was just saying before that the idea for carb appropriate came from a very simple place. It's that at university, we were taught that, you know, we were taught the roles and functions of the nutrients in the body, as you were. Mm-hmm. And we learned that, you know, protein provides the structure for the body. It's the primary building block for cells, tissues, organs. Only a very, very small proportion is used for energy creation, or energy liberation, I should say. Whereas with fat, we have a dual purpose, really. We have a lot of structural components for, you know, hormones, phospholipid membrane around cells, neural tissue, all sorts. And then we obviously also have it as our primary fuel source at low intensity of exercise, at rest, you know, where we're using a lot of fat for fuel. But then if we look at carbohydrate, it's kind of like the inverse of protein. There's very, very minor and very limited roles in terms of structural components. And it's pretty much just a fuel source. Mm-hmm. And that stood in contrast to what we were learning in nutrition class, which was to prescribe high levels of carbohydrate, sort of irrespective of the person's outcome, conditions, metabolic status, etc. Mm. And what I found early on is that if I was dividing up someone's macros, this is in the really early days of my practice back in the late 90s, and I was allocating that high amount of carbohydrate firstly, like we were taught to, there often wasn't enough left in terms of their calorie allotment to optimize protein or fat.
Right.
And so that didn't make sense. Mm. So I flipped it and started optimizing protein first and then allocating carbs and fat depending on the individual based on their outcomes and based on, you know, what they suited, whether that be physiologically or psychologically, psychosocially. And so that was really the idea around carb appropriate. As it happens, in those first couple of years, I was working with a lot of people who were following, you know, due to my guidance, low carb, ketogenic diets. They were getting fantastic results, but that wasn't they weren't the only people I was working with. I was also working with professional athletes who weren't low carb. Mm-hmm. I had them on higher intakes of carbohydrate. And so really the whole idea of carb appropriate is trying to find the best diet fit for the individual. Mm-hmm. And as you and I know, that is more than just the physical. It's more than just the physiological. It's more than just the conditional disease state of the person. It also takes into account all the other stuff that's going on with them psychologically, emotionally, and within their environment.
Yes, for sure. So, and of course, like, you know, that's how we talk over here, like protein first and then carbohydrates, depending on your activity and what, you know, your life looks like, because nutrition isn't a one size fits all. Like, it's very individual depending on what you're doing.
Exactly. And the cool thing now is that's not controversial.
Mm.
You know, back in the day, I got a lot of criticism for going about things that way.
Mm.
Whereas now I think, you know, you speak to most experts, or the people that I think have expertise, they allocate protein first if they're splitting up macros.
Yes.
And then the rest, it actually doesn't matter that much. And, you know, we could get into the weeds and talk about those people for whom low carb is probably better physiologically, those people for whom low fat is probably better physiologically. But at the end of the day, it matters less than optimizing protein, making sure fueling is appropriate. And obviously another big topic that I talk about a lot is making sure micronutrient sufficiency is there. So making sure that we're nutrient replete, because that's probably the, well, I would say that's one of the biggest issues in public health now that is drastically under-recognized, is that people are, you know, what was the old saying, starving to death on a full stomach?
Yes, for sure. And because of the quality of our food.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and I mean, that's a consistent finding. And again, it's, we don't ever want to oversimplify because there's a lot of nuance to it, but a consistent finding is that where people are eating, you know, more natural, more unprocessed, more unrefined foods, that is generally a better thing. Now, that's become a bit of a controversial thing to say, unfortunately, because people will say, well, are you saying that processed food's bad? It's like, no, I'm not. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that as a concept, we tend to get far better outcomes, and it's shown in the research, when we're focusing on foods that are from, you know, a more sort of natural, dare I say it. I'm not falling into the naturalistic fallacy. I'm just basically saying that those foods that aren't ultra processed tend to, as you alluded to just before, have higher nutrient density, better fiber levels. And again, there's context within that. It does become quite complicated because, you know, there's a lot of nuance to diet. But, you know, I think people underestimate the importance of simple concepts. Like, you would have come across this in your time in nutrition, right? People are very critical of the paleo diet. They say, you know, they use anthropological arguments saying, well, there wasn't one paleo diet. And I say, yeah, that's true, but there wasn't one Mediterranean diet either. It actually doesn't matter what people did so much as this provides a conceptual understanding for people that allows them to have a better compendium of food. And while for some people they may use it too restrictively or excessively, you know, the vast majority of people that I know who live a paleo lifestyle, it works well for them because they can understand it. They sort of have this mindset that, oh, if I can see it walking through the forest, then that's what I can eat. It's not necessarily a bad way to go.
That's right. I think, what would you say to people that, you know, like now are then a bit confused about how many carbohydrates they need to eat? Like, obviously, you know, unless they've had their kind of macros done for them, if we're talking to the general population who are kind of just trying to do the best job they can, you know, what advice do you give from that point of view?
It's a really good question, because I think it speaks to the importance of, you know, frying the biggest fish first and working on the biggest factors of health first. And I think if people focus more on overall just having the conceptual understanding that those foods that are more unrefined, more unprocessed are better just in general, and we're trying to focus on those, then that would be step one. Step two, I think if people were following sort of a modular approach to their meals, where they had in their mind, I'm going to prioritize protein, then I'm going to add vegetables, then I'm going to add healthy fats and carbohydrate according to my activity levels or hunger, satiety, those types of things, then they're in most cases going to be pretty well there. The third step would be eat till you're actually full, and then eat again when you're actually hungry. Right. And so within those conceptual things, you've kind of covered off a quality basis for nutrition. You've covered off your macronutrients to some degree, at least, you know, optimizing protein. And you've also covered off meal frequency.
And micronutrients.
Exactly. And I think for most people, most of the time, you'll probably find that those simpler, easier to implement strategies and tactics are going to work really well. Then you might need to fine tune for some people. And that's cool, because then you can get into the weeds of actually calculating out energy and macro splits and things like that. But I think in the first instance, people don't need to worry about that too much.
That's cool. I love that, because that's pretty much like how, you know, obviously how I, because I've learned from you. But what I would love to chat a little bit about is what I find, obviously I'm mainly working with women, and
as I, you know, talk to so many different women, I find that as a society, we have really created an unhealthy relationship with food. Now, that has probably come about through conditioning. Like a lot of women in this kind of bracket have that idea or that concept that to lose weight, they just need to eat less. So then this has created this unhealthy relationship with food where if they have like a treat, then they're feeling guilty. Like, I would love to hear your concept or ideas on creating a healthy relationship with food. So we should never be feeling guilty about eating something that we might enjoy, you know?
100%. The challenge with this whole topic is, the challenges are many, right? We live in a food environment that is obesogenic and not conducive to health. Mm-hmm. So that comes from media, both directly and indirectly, because we're, you know, advertised food that is not that healthy for us if we eat it all the time. We're also exposed to aggressive and highly stimulating media, which drives, you know, stress responses, affects our sleep, etc., which then, you know, limits our food control in subsequent days. Mm-hmm. So we've got an environment that's not really conducive to eating that healthily. Mm-hmm. Then we have societal messaging, which is telling us we need to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of that is really unhelpful. But then we also get a bit of a dichotomy with the way people approach how to get on top of that. And it seems to be that, unfortunately, there's not as much middle ground as there should be. There are a lot of people saying, well, you know, people shouldn't diet, which I probably agree with philosophically, but there are, again, nuance to that. You know, people shouldn't diet. They shouldn't talk about diets. People shouldn't be restrictive at all. People shouldn't have any restraint. You know, people should basically just eat whatever they feel like, whenever they feel like. Then you've got other people on the other side who are like, no, that doesn't work. You need to exercise willpower. You need to count your calories, your macros. You need to have a plan, you know, all these types of things. And I think the reality is somewhere in the middle. As we just talked about a couple of minutes ago, people can implement simple conceptual or like strategy tactical changes that become habits. You know, I often talk with my clients about this because the reality is most of the meals that we eat that are putting us off track, we're not eating because of social enjoyment or taste, you know, any of those types of things. We're eating because it's there or it's what we've always done, what we're used to, or in some cases, because we are eating for other purposes. You know, we're eating emotionally or whatever, which is completely fine. But for all those functional meals, like for most people, breakfast, lunch, even dinner, you know, it's very easy to switch those around and have them be healthier and go from a situation of maybe eating what you and I might consider to be a healthy diet 10 to 20% of the time to eating a healthy diet 80 to 90% of the time. Sure. That's where things are going to work, right? And so this is why I talk about the idea of freedom within structure. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of simple things we can do to create the structures that will allow us to, and the behaviors that will allow us to get those really good results over time. But because we're doing that, we don't need to be excessively rigid, because then if you really feel like something, sure, eat it, you know? And if you want to have a treat, have a treat. Yeah. There are even, you know, tactics that I'm sure you use as well. There are tactics that we can use for ourselves or with our clients that can be conducive to that as well. Like one that I am a big fan of is make your treats an expedition. You know, don't just have stuff in the house.
Right. Okay.
Because if you're not feeling that, you know, if you're feeling a little bit down or whatever, you're just going to grab whatever's there, right? But I've certainly found that if I don't have all that stuff in the house, I might still eat something that wouldn't be on my usual sort of regimen, but it wouldn't be
to the same
that type of food. Yeah, you know. But if I really want that stuff, that's completely cool. I've just got to go out and get it.
Yeah.
So I have to walk to the shop. I have to go and get it. You know, it makes it one of those interesting things where you might have a greater block to actually doing it then.
Sure.
But the other interesting thing with that is when you have to go out and get it, it helps, I think, amongst the process of breaking down the shame and the stigma. Mm. You know, I know a lot of, I've worked with a lot of clients who will not eat cake out because they don't want to be seen eating it, right?
Wow.
But they'll quite happily sit and eat an entire cake at home.
Yeah.
The problem is that whole process is wrapped up with guilt and shame. Mm. And that's not what it should be. I had a good chat with my friend, you know, my good mate, Dr. Eric Helms, yeah. at a conference years ago. And he, I said, oh, you know, I have a good binge in the weekend. And he pulled me up on it and he said, well, it's not actually a binge, is it? If we're talking about, you know, the psychology of eating. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, there's no guilt or shame associated with it, right? I was like, no, of course not. I you know, yeah. on a Friday night, we typically have burgers and fries and we have chocolate and all sorts of stuff because that's what we do and we enjoy it. Yeah. But it's not counter to our health at all. And I don't feel any guilt or shame when I'm doing that. So in effect, that's not actually a binge.
Mm, true.
What it is just eating a lot.
Yes. Yes.
And that's a whole different context, right?
Yep.
I know I'm talking too much now, but there's a really interesting thing that a student said years ago. I was running a workshop and I was talking about the framing we use because that can be really important, the vernacular, the wording, right? Because that's an important part of triggering our sort of autonomic processes and encouraging those autonomic processes to be more conducive to health. Like if we tell ourselves negative stuff all the time, we will start to live that out.
Yes.
And one of the words I was using as an example is cheat. You know, it's like for a lot of people saying a cheat meal, a cheat day, it's actually not that helpful because it casts it into a negative light. They feel that guilt or shame.
Yes.
Which I think is true in most cases. But this student said, I don't feel that way because I come from a coding and gaming background.
Uh-huh.
And for us, a cheat is something that is a way to basically trick the system so we get a better result.
Uh-huh.
So if I have a big cheat meal on Friday night, I know that I'm going to be full of glycogen. I'm going to have a great train the next day. And for me, it's only got positive,
right?
You know, outcomes. And that was a really cool thing to hear because it goes to show that what works for one does not work for another.
Yeah.
You know, we've done research on moderation versus abstention.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, one of the reasons low carb works is because it's easier. They don't need to think about things too much. They just know that these carb foods I don't eat because they don't really work for me that well. Why? Not because they're evil, not because they're bad, not because carbs are going to make you fat or anything like that. It's more so that for those people, they felt that when they were eating that way, they didn't have much control and they kept on eating.
Yes. Yes.
But on the other hand, we had the moderators who were like, you know what? I actually stick to a healthy diet better when I allow myself to have some kumara, some rice, some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's cool because you've got a different outlook and philosophy on food, and that's ingrained within your psychoneurophysiology. And that's cool.
Yeah.
Whatever helps you get results is the way to go.
That's right. Do you think as a society we need to start, like, looking at this? Because I feel like a lot of people struggle with having actually a healthy relationship with food. You know, like having, they can't just have a Tim Tam and feel like that's okay. It's then there's something about it, you know, which, I mean, how could we change that?
I think we need to start thinking a lot bigger. I think one of our big issues is that we really compartmentalize these things down. So, you know, we'll often talk about a healthy relationship with food.
Mm.
You know, is a healthy relationship with food really what we're after? Or would that flow from a healthy relationship with ourselves,
yeah,
with people around us, with our environment, with society?
Mm.
You know, it's a fractal thing and it grows and grows and grows.
True.
And I sum this up. I've given a similar talk a number of times at, you know, medical conferences, at health conferences, at all sorts of things about going beyond health. And what I mean by that is health has become such an objectively desirable outcome for people.
Mm.
When I started in this industry, probably like when you did, it was actually pretty weird to be as obsessed about food as I am. Whereas now everyone's obsessed with food, right? Everyone's taking snaps of their food for Instagram and everyone follows this diet or that diet. Like, it's a really pervasive thing.
Yeah.
But if I ask people about their ideas around health, it becomes very clear that a lot of their ideas around health are driven by what they see in media, what they see in social media, and it's all sort of extrinsically driven stuff.
Mm.
So when I say going beyond health, it's more about asking, you know, why? And this is something obviously that's a coaching process. Mm. When we have a client and they say, oh, I've got this goal, we'll explore with them why they have that goal. Okay. And the goal is not, for example, to run a marathon. The goal is typically to be healthier,
yeah,
you know, fitter, have more energy. Mm-hmm. But then we go deeper than that. Why is that important? Mm. Oh, because, you know, I want to have more cognition because I love what I do, or I want to be better at playing the guitar. I want to spend more time with my kids and I want it to be quality time. You know, we start to get to far more evocative things. Mm-hmm. And so I think once we start to understand how we want our lives to be and how we want society to be, we begin to break down those barriers so much better. You know, we start to appreciate ourselves. We start to have a better relationship with ourselves. True. And then that flows into, I think, having a better relationship with food.
Yeah, true.
Because if it's all extrinsically driven, extrinsically motivated, we know that extrinsic motivators don't work that well.
Yeah, that's right.
We need to be internally driven to achieve those things, because they're going to be so important, so tangible, so evocative. It's going to make our life so much better if we do that.
Yeah, true. I love that. That's so good. Now we're going to shift gears because, and I've messaged you quite a number of times about this, but a lot of the menopausal tribe here, they want to know about electrolytes. So I know you have like a super easy, like natural solution for this, but people, this is one of the messages I get like just all the time. Like, how do I find a good electrolyte? What does it look like? What should I be looking for? Like, and you can, of course, like, you know, give your natural solution as well. I would love to get your take on that.
It's a really good question, because I think that the importance of an electrolyte drink, I think, is a little bit overstated. And I think particularly it comes through the low carb community, because in those early stages of induction, whether it be to a low carb or ketogenic diet, yes, we will lose additional sodium, potassium, and water. Mm-hmm. And so then a lot of people in that space say, oh, you need to be taking an electrolyte. And then it becomes this thing that people feel they need to take forever. Or you've got people in the naturopathic community saying, well, you know, you've got adrenal fatigue or some other sort of hormonal imbalance, which is going to increase your requirement for sodium. Mm-hmm. And I don't really believe any of either of those things are true per se. And the reason I say that is because the body, especially in that sort of low carb or keto induction phase, you know, understanding that I've studied this stuff a lot, it adapts very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't continue to excrete higher than normal levels of sodium, potassium. The body balances itself. It returns to homeostasis fairly quickly. And so it's really only in those first few days that we need that.
Mm-hmm.
However, some people are higher sodium excretors. You know, if people are exercising a lot, they might benefit from an electrolyte drink. So I've got no problem whatsoever with people taking electrolytes. Here's the next part of the story. The primary electrolyte we excrete through sweat is sodium. Mm-hmm. So that should really be the key thing in an electrolyte drink. And the rest are not really that important.
Right.
So that's why I typically say to people, you know, a quarter to a half a teaspoon of salt in a liter of water with a squeeze of lemon or lime is completely fine. And that's going to do exactly the same job as any fancy electrolyte drink.
Yeah.
But, you know, the biggest factor when it comes to an electrolyte drink, what tastes best to you?
Yeah, true. Exactly. Yeah.
Because the research is very clear that if people don't like the taste, they won't drink it. So you might as well use something you enjoy.
Yeah, true. So when you say salt, does it have to be sea salt, Himalayan salt? Does it need to be a type of salt?
Any old salt.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. And I personally don't have a problem with iodized salt,
mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people, you know, don't get enough iodine. The reason iodine was added to salt was specifically to help with that, because goiter was so common previously, mm-hmm. and it's not anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just typically potassium iodide, which is added in there. So a little bit of potassium, a little bit of iodine, no big deal.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Well, that is great. So everyone now knows they don't have to stress. Like you said, if you've got one that you enjoy, then go for it. But I see a lot of people spending a lot of money on electrolytes these days, and possibly it may not be necessary. So you guys can work that out. But we've got the facts now, which is great. The next question is around protein powders. So, you know, how does one person look for a good quality protein powder? What would they be looking for?
I think, you know, there's a lot of different proteins that can work well for people. I tend to gravitate towards just good old, you know, whey proteins, even if they're just a whey protein concentrate or a pea protein isolate, because they tend to be the highest quality, best value for money, aside from if you've got a, you know, some sort of dairy allergy, because although most dairy allergies are casein, there is a rising incidence of combined milk protein allergies. And so some people will be intolerant or allergic to whey. But in the absence of that, they're both considered relatively low allergen, not a lot of other things in there that typically bother people. I guess for people with sensitive guts, they should just really look out for some of the fillers that are put in, or thickeners like xanthan gum, carrageenan, or carboxymethylcellulose, because they can be irritants. Okay. And especially so if people have IBS or they have an inflammatory bowel disorder. But, you know, typically a good quality whey protein or a good quality pea protein is going to be all you need.
And so what about sweeteners or any other kind of additives? Or do we look for the kind of most natural, or does it not really matter?
Honestly, I don't think it matters too much. I think when we're looking at the research, you know, there are potential risks with artificial sweeteners, but they're very limited. They're very minor. We can't be 100% sure they're real in some cases, because, you know, especially when we're looking at observational evidence, we might see, for example, a slightly higher risk of diabetes or metabolic syndrome. But a lot of that can be accounted for by reverse causation, because people with overweight, with obesity, people with, you know, metabolic syndrome disorders are more likely to be taking actions that are helping to correct that. So they're more likely to be using sugar-free drinks and things like that. Anyway, what we're really seeing if we look at the evidence is that it's really associated with extremely high doses. So, you know, a little bit of artificial sweetener here and there is highly, highly unlikely to be any sort of risk. Now, if people were concerned about that, yeah, there are natural sweeteners like stevia, which has, you know, a long history of traditional use. It's considered to be very safe. So you can veer towards that. But I personally think that there's not any appreciable risk from, say, aspartame or sucralose either.
So, like, when you say, like, a high quality whey or pea isolate, how would the general person know that this product here is high quality? Like, how would they work that out?
So typically there are levels to this, right? If someone is an athlete and they're worried about potential contaminants, then making sure that something is certified by Informed Sport or a similar agency where it's been tested. Outside of that, if it's a reputable company, so it's a company you've heard of, you know, it's a big company, it has good quality control, that's usually a pretty good indicator of what you're going to get in the tub as well. And then I think the next thing is to look at the protein content, right? If the protein content is really low, like we're talking about, you know, 50% or something, you know, there's a lot of other rubbish in there. So you want that protein content to be high. Or looking at the other nutrients, you know, you'd want the carbohydrate quantity and fat quantity to be really low, because what you're buying is protein. And then, you know, probably the third thing is I would veer towards lesser ingredients being better, just because I know for a fact you don't need to put a ton of ingredients in to make it taste good and have good texture. And the more ingredients that are in there, the more likely there is something that you might react negatively to. But yeah, that's pretty much what I would be looking at.
Yeah, awesome. So the last thing I want to ask you about really quickly is, for any females that are like 40 plus that are like, I mean, I don't want to say the word athlete, because athlete is so like such a wide like
scale, but you know, they're highly active. I mean, maybe they're athletes, masters athletes. Do you have any advice, like, for, you know, 40 plus, like, as you age, you know, kind of still wanting to be competitive, or any specific, because you have a lot of knowledge in this area as well?
Yeah, and if I'm asked to work directly with, you know, female athletes, menopausal athletes and whatnot, I of course I can do that, and I have done a lot in the past, but I tend to refer on to people who have more of that lived experience now, people like yourself, or, you know, Mickey Willardin and whatnot, because you live the experience of being in a female body, right? Which I don't do. Despite the fact that I've got pink hair ties in today. It's not really the same. But I think when you take a step back from that, I had a lot of real success in the very early days of my practice. As, you know, a young nutritionist, I was in my early 20s. I had a mohawk. I was into, like, fighting and lifting weights and stuff like this. And I was known for a short time as being like a menopause guy. And I never wanted to be that. It was just that I had some clients who came to me and they got fantastic results. Mm-hmm. So people would think, well, you must have a really cool prescription for menopause. Mm-hmm. And I do. Oh. It's doing the basics.
Yeah. Well, I love that.
It's having the foundation set. And so it's really similar to what I would say as the foundation for anyone, is we need to make sure that we are covering those bases of quality movement, sleep, you know, stress mitigation. And then with nutrition, one of the biggest things that is drastically under-recognized is nutrient insufficiency. Mm-hmm. And I see it time and time again with women. Mm-hmm. Right, is that they, whether they're eating too little or too much, because those are two different things, they might still not be taking in enough of those micronutrients or essential fatty acids, and particularly not enough protein. Mm-hmm. So I think cover those bases first. Make sure you're eating enough to fuel what you need to do. Yep. Make sure that you're prioritizing protein. Make sure that you're eating loads of vegetables. I do think taking a good supportive multi every day is a really good idea. Mm-hmm. I think taking a good fish oil daily is a good idea as well. Yep. I think if you need it, take a protein powder, mm-hmm. because it just helps. It's a really cost-effective way to get that protein in. Yep. And then see where you're at, because I find that a lot of people, and particularly women nowadays, are sort of being scared into doing things like getting a whole bunch of extensive and very expensive testing done.
Yep.
When they haven't worked on the foundations first. And if they worked on the foundations first, that testing might be redundant. Or being scared out of doing certain things that they know work for them. Mm-hmm. Like they're being told by experts, don't fast.
Right, yeah.
And I think that advice is great for someone who tends towards under-eating. Mm. Because they might be forced into further, like, nutrient depletion, further undernourishment if they're fasting. But for the person who trends towards overeating, fasting might be a really good strategy. It's all about horses for courses. Same thing with, you know, women must eat before training. Mm-hmm. No, they don't have to. That's patently ridiculous. It depends entirely on the type of exercise, the person, the type of exercise, the volume of that exercise. And so there aren't any absolute rules, but there is science. And unfortunately, we've got a lot of scientists who are saying things that are contradicted by the science. Another really interesting one: don't drink coffee first thing in the morning.
Oh, yes.
Because it's going to, you know, it's going to destroy your, it's going to spike your cortisol. Yeah, it's going to, and it's going to affect your production of female sex hormones. Mm. A study just came out, 4 milligrams per kilo body weight of caffeine had no effect on female sex hormones whatsoever, except for a very tiny reduction in prolactin, right? But what we've also got to look at is dose effects here. I've written a review on this because people say don't drink coffee in the morning because it spikes cortisol along with all those other negative effects that they think it has. Mm. But when those effects are typically seen with 6 milligrams per kilo of body weight, that's a massive whack of caffeine, yeah. Right? Yeah. Under 3 milligrams, which is still a big whack of caffeine, we tend to not see any distortion in cortisol levels.
Right.
So me, I'm not a huge person, but I'm a relatively big, well-muscled person. I'm 90 kilos at 5'9". So for me, six megs per kilo is, what is that? 540 milligrams of caffeine. 5.5 strong coffees in one go.
That's a lot.
There's no way I'm doing that. I'm going to be a jittery mess if I do that. So my 1 to 2 coffees in the morning is no big deal. Just like your 1 to 2 coffees in the morning is probably no big deal either.
Well, the similar thing is around the fasting, because there's different, like you said, scientists saying women shouldn't be fasting and training fasted. And I've always trained fasted. And clearly, I mean, I'm still getting PBs. They're saying if you train fasted, it's like spiking your cortisol. It's the same with like even what exercise women should be doing now in this stage. Like, and so I've been having conversations with women like recently, because then I've had runners, then I can't run anymore. I'm like, no, that is not the case. Like, people are now scared to exercise.
Yeah. And as someone looking in from the outside, so because I'm a man, you know, I don't have the lived experience, so I'm not really qualified to comment on what's going in, you know, on within that community. But from the outside looking in, to me at least, it looks like it's disempowerment wrapped up in feminism. So it's sort of got the guise of feminism, because we're doing things for women, you know, based on women's physiology. Mm. You know, we're researching female physiology and stuff. Mm. But what we're in fact doing is telling women for whom fasting works not to fast. Mm. And we're telling women not to do high intensity training because somehow it's going to break them, like they're little fragile things, you know. Mm. To me, I know a lot of really strong, capable women, and they're weapons, and that's wicked. Why not just let them do what they're doing and getting these great results? Yeah,
exactly.
You know, especially when a lot of what is said is not actually backed by evidence, or it's using evidence inappropriately. The low carb thing is a really good example of that.
Yeah.
You know, don't go low carb because it will basically destroy female hormonal balance. The evidence doesn't show us that at all. It's based on one study by Lukes and Thurmer, which showed that it's a complicated study to read, and I think that's why people misread it. In a nutshell, what people think it says is that low carb reduces luteinizing hormone pulsatility, right? But the diet itself wasn't low carb. If you look at it proportionally, the proportion of carbs within that diet were actually really high. The carbohydrate availability that they published in the data was very low, but that's because it took into account the exercise that the women were doing, and they were extraordinarily energy restricted, right? So what we were seeing wasn't an example of low carb destroying hormone balance. It was an example of the known situation of energy deficiency causing hormonal irregularities, whether they're, you know, male or female. So this speaks to the importance of optimizing fueling. But if you're optimizing your fueling using a lower carb approach, where maybe more of that fuel's made up with fat because that's what feels good to you and that's what allows you to stay leaner and whatever, who cares? I'm not worried about that in the slightest.
Because this is one of the struggles I've had. Like, there's a lot of, I'm not going to name the people who are doing the research, but saying that, you know, women shouldn't train fasted or shouldn't be doing intermittent fasting in menopause. Like, and I know for a fact, I've been doing it for 7 years and I'm thriving. So and I get people sending me this stuff all the time. Oh, like XYZ said, you can't fast. Like, you know, it's how do we manage this, you know?
And even if we take it, you know, I'll always default to the position of optimized fueling. And any strategy that can help you to optimize fueling is beneficial. And for some people, that might mean greater meal frequency. For others, it might mean lesser meal frequency. For some people, it might mean that they fast in the morning. For others, it might mean that they have a protein breakfast first thing when they wake up. Mm. Any of those strategies are fine. But even if we consider that, let's consider for a second that they're right. And this works for almost all women. And I don't believe that. But let's say that we assume they're right. It works for nearly all women. Mm. There are always going to be outliers. Mm. And not just a few. There's going to be a lot. Like when we look at the individual variability in research data, it's really wide. It's massive. Mm. And so we default to the mean and we default to the deviations around that mean, but there are often still significant minorities of people that are outliers. Mm. And if you're one of those outliers and you're being, and fasting works really well for you and only the individual will know that, then there is absolutely no good reason to try and default to the mean. Mm. And again, my buddy Eric and I have talked about this, you know, like best practice guidelines are really useful because they, you know, they do work for that mean and most people around it, but they're a starting point. They're not the end point for clinical practice. The end point for clinical practice is moving immediately from the mean to meet the person. Mm. And that individual strategy might be quite different in exactly the same way that I would still contend, based on my research, based on my experience, that for someone with diabetes, the best diet they could follow is a low-carb diet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But can they get good results on a high-carb diet? Absolutely they can.
Yeah, right.
So if that person with diabetes hates low-carb, while I don't think a higher-carb diet will be as effective, it can still be effective.
Mm, right.
You know, if we look at the research between insulin-sensitive and insulin-resistant people, we might say that based on what's been published to date, people who are more insulin-resistant probably get better fat loss results on a low-carb diet. Those people who are more insulin-sensitive actually probably get better results on a low-fat, higher-carb diet. But look at the data. Everybody got results on every diet. Yeah,
that's right.
Because if you've got a diet that is eliciting an energy restriction, you'll lose fat.
I guess at the end of the day, it comes down to, like, if you are not happy with your results you're getting, if, you know, if you're suffering with menopausal symptoms, if you're not, you know, your body composition is out of control and you, you know, I guess it comes down to, if you're not happy then with what you're doing, then you need to look at whether that's working for you.
Exactly. And we also need to be more concerned about the how within someone's lifestyle rather than the what.
Mm.
You know, what I mean by that is, how can someone adjust their health regimen to more easily take in the right amount of fuel and the right amount of nutrients?
Right.
Right. And so this is where we talk about, you know, auto-regulation of nutrition. I talk about this a lot in the course, mm-hmm. right? How do we provide better auto-regulation? Well, if someone tends towards overeating and that's just their pattern, that doesn't mean they're bad or they're wrong.
Mm.
It just means that that's their tendency. That's cool. There are things we can do to change the levers of their diet, increase their protein. Sure, maybe for that person, fasting might work well. Whereas the person on the other end of the spectrum who tends towards under-eating, they should probably eat more meals.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they should increase their carb intake because that's probably going to be less satiating, so they'll eat more. There are lots of different ways to skin a cat, and it's about finding the how that can easily allow you to get those results in the long term.
Yeah, for sure. This has been so good. I'm really, like, we've gone way over time. But I think there's some really great information here for everyone. And, you know, thank you so much. For anyone, lots of people actually do reach out and ask me, you know, who did I study with? And so if anyone is listening to this and they're thinking about wanting to be a nutritionist or a health coach, then I will definitely point you in the right direction and put all of the details in the show notes for you. You can come and learn from Cliff as well. But thank you for joining us today, Cliff. I truly appreciate it. It's, you know, really, like, means a lot to me. And I know this information is going to really, like, serve so many people. So thank you so much.
Cool. Thanks, Chanel. Anytime you want me back, I'll come on and we'll just wrap.
We'll probably have to do a refresh down the track. You know, that some of the questions that come through, you know, I think it's good to have a male's perspective as well, but obviously your knowledge in this, you know, space is like unprecedented. And so I love just chatting to you anyway. So thank you so much.
And have a great day.
I hope you enjoyed this chat with Cliff. I truly value his opinion and hope this information really helps you on your health and wellness journey. And as always, if you're happy to leave a review, a rating, share, like, follow, I would truly appreciate it. That's how others can find this podcast and also better their own health and wellness journey. If you have not signed up for the next round of my Thrive program, it will be kicking off in June. I'll drop the link here. Make sure you join in. And can't wait to see you next time. Have the best day.